Okay, now we're turning our attention to a section that I've called The Pastor is Environmental Engineer, Creating a Climate for Cooperation, Not Collision. Now, we can look at the role of the pastor in many ways, but I like to think about him as being in charge of climate control. Because when the climate is right, everybody is set free to flourish and grow and do what they do best. So how can a pastor help people cooperate with one another and not collide? This is the proactive stance for dealing with difficult people. It's being on the lookout for the potholes, the trouble spots, before we're in the thick of them. Being aware that it is the little foxes that spoil the vines. So, pastor, as you know, your job, your responsibility, your privilege is to work on building, fostering, and modeling life-giving relationships. Business is now realizing that a leader's greatest skill is his or her ability to relate to people well. That is the determining factor of success. Structures define our roles, but it is the relationships which empower us, says Ted Haggart in the Life-Giving Church. So we're wanting to foster relationships that receive and give life. And I'll be talking about this much more when we describe healthy community together. Certainly, we in the church are not working for a corporation. We are working on relationships. As an old Baptist pastor said, relationships are the only thing we'll take to heaven with us. I think it was a Baptist pastor that said that, but then aren't a lot of good old sayings attributed to old Baptist pastors? Anyway, what we want to do is cultivate relationship, relationship, relationship. Cultivate the relationships on your board and your leadership team. Do it through retreats. Do some trainings about difficult people. Look for people to work with you in the ministry with whom you have a sense of divine connection, says John Osteen in his book Divine Flow. Now, by that, he doesn't mean some slavish imitation. He's not telling you to gather yes men around you. But instead, we want to find people that will challenge us at the same time as we know they're really for us. So, pastors, use the pulpit as a platform for imparting vision and values. I would just ask you, are you preaching yet another series on the Great Tribulation? Or are you preaching about the troubles we encounter with one another as we learn how to get along? So use the rightful power of the pulpit to teach that encouragers get more attention than complainers, that they get the pastor's ear quicker than the critic does. If the pastor knows a parishioner is really for him, he will hear feedback much more readily and freely than a chronic complainer with whom he's understandably wary. Teach and model that this church values people more than the program, more than perfection, more than the agenda, more than the goals. Teach how to deal with difficult people, how to manage conflict, how to disagree with leadership. What do you teach in your membership classes? Wouldn't this be a good place to go into more detail about how to bring your suggestions, your ideas, your questions, your concerns to leadership? Teach manners. We have a mandate to behave well in the house of the Lord. So, teach, being very specific, that gossip is not okay. Nor are there any cutesy little disguises that are allowed either, like, let's pray for poor Mr. So-and-so who's fallen off the wagon again. Nope, we're not allowed nosiness. We're not allowed to breach people's boundaries. We're not allowed to triangulate. We can't go to Bill and whine and complain about John and all the problems we have with him. We need to go directly to John to work things out. Again, we have to lead by example. When a parishioner comes to you to complain about so-and-so, say, go to that person. Don't come to me. We need to teach the value of routine prayer ministry, making the giving and receiving of prayer a routine practice for everyone in the church, not just when you're desperate. Or train people up to be comfortable and equipped to pray for one another. And I've seen this over and over again in the church, that church members are just simply not comfortable with praying for each other. They for too long thought, well, that's the job of the pastor. That's what pastors do. I've been in many services where the pastor has given an invitation at the end just to come up for prayer, for more infilling of the life of Jesus, or if there's special requests, or for salvation, or whatever. And the pastor was the one who did all the praying. We're all dealing with difficult people and difficult, stressful situations. If we have to wait until the pastor gets around to us to pray, we are in dire straits. Call all to the higher standard that is in Jesus. Arouse a passion to know him more intimately. And call everyone, leadership and members alike, to a disciplined, ever-deepening walk with the Lord. That constant call to put off our difficult side and put on Jesus. Make worship a high value in all gatherings. Because as we focus on adoring Jesus together, conflict and tension dissipates. Well, certainly you have worship at Sunday services. You probably have worship at a midweek service. But do you make worship a part of every meeting that you have? How about your business meeting? How about your staff meetings, where you, without any musical instruments, you would just sing a hymn or a chorus, several, as you adore the Lord to begin, and then as you close? It is an absolute miracle. I have seen so many times church meetings where discussion became heated, or even sharp debate ensued. The tension was palpable, and then we closed with a hymn or chorus and prayer. Suddenly the atmosphere again became clear and harmonious as we joined our voices and hearts together in worshiping the Lord, whom we all serve and love. As we focus on the Lord together, we get a deep awareness of his majesty, his supremacy, his ability to bring good out of every difficult situation. So worship isn't that thing we do just to get ready for the message. It is so much more than that. It's adoring the Lord and ushering in his presence. And in his presence, we begin to know how to cooperate with him and with each other and create an environment where we don't collide, but we live in harmony together. Here's another way that we can promote an atmosphere that discourages difficult behavior. And that is to raise up and use intercessors. I've talked about this several times before, but it needs underlining here. We recognize the work of the enemy, that we wrestle far more with principalities and powers than with flesh and blood. We have to practice what we preach, though, and surround ourselves and our ministry with intercessory prayer. I'm surprised, though, by just how many churches don't have an active and organized intercessory ministry within the church. Here again, when you mention intercession, often people think, well, that's something that some of the older ladies do in the church, or it is something that only a person with very, very deep spirituality would ever be able to do, not a normal person like me. So, Pastor, have a personal intercessor that you can confide in, and have intercessory prayer going on before each service and during the service. What I'm saying is, if you don't already have an intercessory prayer ministry established, make it a high priority to do so if you know what's good for you and for your people. Well, here's some more on creating that climate of cooperation and not collision. Watch your tongue. assume anything negative you say to anyone will be repeated. So be very circumspect. Set up ways people can give feedback on a routine basis. Don't wait until a crisis. One church I know of has the elders visit every home each year with the goal of hearing what is going well and what is not. They don't run the church by polls, but they take into consideration what the people are saying. Another church gives out quarterly evaluation sheets. They actually distribute these through the small groups in their church. And here again, the idea is that we want feedback from you. We want you to evaluate how church life is for you. We want to know what things are going well and what you see could be done better. Also, foster a climate of unqualified acceptance and a high tolerance for failure as we resolutely grow in maturity. All of us, I think, need at least 4 encouragements for every criticism. Although, one pastor said, forget that. I need at least 10 attaboys to make up for the times I'm told I'm a jerk. It is only when we are constantly encouraged and supported that we have the confidence and vulnerability to accept a correction. If we build up an account of acceptance, then we can draw from it when we need to give some negative feedback. When we live in this climate of unqualified acceptance, the air we breathe, as it were, the all-pervasive tone, is one of safety and security. The messages are, I accept you. I believe in you. I see you as you honestly are, including your difficult side, and I still want to, in fact, I'm glad to, stay involved with you. I want to give to you without forcing you to change, even while I continue to encourage and incite you to further growth. In other words, foster a climate of unity. We're all in this together. How good and how pleasant it is when brothers live together in unity, says Psalm 133. And conversely, how bad and how unpleasant it is when they don't. We can all choose to react in the old self-serving ways. Instead, let us work together in something that is far bigger than our own individual pet peeves. Pastors, you want to teach the value of diversity versus division, that we are interdependent. We're not codependent or independent. The Apostle Paul is always saying to put off quarreling and be unified, be humble, be gentle, bearing one another in love, keeping the unity through the bond of peace. The unity factor isn't an option. It is a command. Whatever it takes, we must come into unity and peace with each other. When Paul talks about divisions, he reminds the church that we are a collective organism, a field, a building, an army, a temple, a body. We need to continue to teach the biblical values of in honor preferring one another, of that interdependence that I was talking about, that there are no good guys here or bad guys, that this is not a sheep and goats issue, that we don't categorize the people in this world as the difficult ones and the easy ones, the saints and the sinners, the winners and the losers. The early church of the New Testament flourished in very hard times because of the unity factor. And as Marshall Shelley says, the best defense for difficult people is to create an atmosphere that breeds mutual advocates, not adversaries. For when peace and unity are evident, we show that God's in the house. So cultivate a family atmosphere. One pastor I know does this through announcements. They take a good half hour in his church. But he does announcements like you've never heard them done before. During that time, he interviews people in his church about what the Lord is doing in their life. He has the youth come up and testify about what is going on with them. He creates an atmosphere that we're family here. He does it with humor, playfulness, and even some good-natured teasing. He gives a sense that the life of the community is filled with acceptance, with the celebration of real people, with fun. He praises the church. You feel you just want to be a part of this community. And he does all of this in announcements time. So how do our people grow? How do they change? How are they healed? It all happens within a family, within a community. It does take a village to raise a child. It happens by coming to the end of all our isolating, sinful, independent ways and coming back to the Father and his family. Remember when the press interviewed Defendant Rodney King at the height of the Los Angeles riots? That simple phrase has become so famous, hasn't it? "Why can't we all just get along?" he said plaintively. Why indeed? Outside the grace of Jesus, we can never live in harmony with ourselves, our neighbors, or our world. We are in a quandary. In our fallen state, we are alienated from God and others. We have all inherited from Adam the desire to be independent, like sheep that go astray. We have all gone our own way, as Isaiah says. We continue in the proud delusion that our self-will and our self-enterprise will be enough. We long to come close to one another, but at the same time we shrink back from being close to one another. The closer we dare to come, the more opportunity for hurt. This is the most basic human dilemma, and is at the root of all our conflict, this ambivalence, this push-pull, this tension between longing and fear of intimacy. The way back home is to face our pain, to come to the end of ourselves, and in brokenness and repentance, come back into restored life with the Father and his family, with whom, after all, we'll be spending eternity. But we don't really want to believe that the only way we can flourish is through the very relationships that threaten us. This fear of engaging with one another keeps us from giving and receiving life. So what is it that we're all crying out for? What is it that we want underneath all our difficult ways? It is, I believe, to belong to a people who fully receive us, who delight in us, who love us, and who call us to our highest potential. We need brothers and sisters who want to be in our lives, who want to be in our struggles, our celebration, who want to be our friends, who believe that the good news applies to us, that we can be fully forgiven, and who believe that we want to be good, and that the new life and power of the Holy Spirit in us will win out over the deeds of our flesh. So to create a climate for cooperation and not collision, we must impart a new vision of community, that place that we all long for, and we must do it in every way we can, and then put legs on it. So with that, I come to the main thesis of this entire course, and that is that community is our best, is in fact our only hope for dealing effectively with difficult people. You see, the community can deal with difficult people much more effectively than one-to-one relationships can. Community answers the need both for oneself, because we can't grow on our own, and the difficult others, because we can't bring them to maturity alone either. Here's what a pastor said who had just resigned after dealing with one too many difficult people in his church. I have a strong theological training. I've got a good marriage. I've had successful previous pastorates, but I went down. What I realized I really needed was a group of 5 or 6 friends who would love me and challenge me through thick and thin, no matter what. Well, we don't have it all together, but together we have it all. And we can't just hope that the difficult people in our lives will somehow get right with the Lord at the next revival meetings, or that they will come to the altar, or they'll start attending prayer meeting, or whatever. No, we have to go beyond this. That is good, but we have to do more. We have to provide places of both acceptance and accountability on a week-in, week-out basis, so that we can together, in a communal sense, in a corporate sense, put off our difficult side and not try to do so in isolation. What I'm saying here is that difficult people problems cannot be resolved in one-to-one relating alone. This is not just for the pastor to take care of, or the counselor, or whomever. It is not sufficient to say, well, this is a moral problem we have here. Yeah, it's the flesh, it's the sinful nature, all right. But it's simply not helpful to give the simplistic, legalistic response, shape up, get with the program. Nor is it helpful alone to say, well, the problem is emotional wounding. It's unhealed traumas from the past that are influencing the current difficult behavior. So let's get this person into counseling. No, by definition, we've said that this is an ongoing, chronic, seemingly irresolvable situation. If a person is truly difficult, then we can't find a good resolution. We've tried, and nothing has worked. Some people simply do not respond to all our good intentions and our great techniques. Moreover, they uncover our own issues, our own hot buttons, our own need to grow. The conclusion is this. We must face our own need to become more Christ-like. We must recognize we can't deal with the root causes of difficult behavior on one-to-one relationships only. So the best remedy for all us difficult people is healthy community. But notice that I said healthy community here, because if the community isn't healthy, it in and of itself will just spawn more difficult people. The best prevention, or at least minimizing collateral damage, is to concentrate on what it takes to maintain health, and then do it. Shelley says, a close, cohesive church will produce better results than the shrewdest political maneuvers after problems sprout. This is building up the immune system. It increases the probability that there will be healthy, productive exchanges rather than destructive, debilitating ones. So how do we do this? We do it by finding out what healthy looks like and implementing it, as well as, and I would say even more than, trying to figure out what to do when things go wrong. I find this analogy of healthy community being like a healthy immune system quite interesting. The medical community tends to study people who get sick instead of those who stay well. For example, until quite recently, AIDS patients who were long-term survivors were basically ignored. No one thought to analyze them to see why they were staying alive and others were not. Also, it's not too long ago that the Journal of the American Medical Association and 35 other medical journals from 21 countries around the world simultaneously wrote about infectious diseases. Hardly a word was said about the best treatment of all, our inborn defensive immune system. This is a little like my giving you all the problems of difficult people and all the destruction they cause, but not mentioning how to have healthy community. I could also say, take this pill, this remedy when you get hit. That's all fine. However, that is of little help to you if your immune system isn't functioning well. The medical community does the same thing in the emotional area. In other words, more rigorously researches sickness and gives little attention to wellness. For example, David Myers says in The Pursuit of Happiness that it's been again only recently that research has begun to include people who are happy and contented with their lives. Before, focused research was always on those who were miserable and how we could end their suffering. Certainly, we know people have problems. Counseling focuses on the problem. But community focuses on wellness. It is on fostering growth. It comes from a whole different orientation. So instead of focusing on the difficult person's shortcomings, all the ways this person is so impossible, you focus on bringing the difficult person into health. As we hold a model of wellness, of the ideal, it will become evident where we fall short or where we are lacking in health. So we must know what a healthy community truly is, then preach it, talk it up, model it, implement it systematically, not just as another good program for the church, but as a way of life. This is the end of 7.